Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
September 4th, 2016, and welcome to episode 136 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and just catching up with what's happening in the retro world. Hi, I'm Mike Mulhern, and I'm your host for episode 136. With me today is Ken. How are you, Mr. Gagne?
Hello, Michael. I'm fine on this beautiful Sunday afternoon here in Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, I'm glad it's a nice day there. It was definitely a good weekend here in Sydney.
Have you gotten to bicycle much in this beautiful weather of yours?
I will be, but haven't at the moment. It's been a little bit cold here in winter. Like even this morning, it's 6 degrees Celsius, so still a little bit on the cool side to get out.
Yeah, that's in the 40s, I think.
Yeah, I used to get out in this kind of weather, but that was back in my young and I couldn't care less days.
Now you're just old and couldn't care less.
Correct. Okay, and over in Boston land as well is Paul. How are you, Mr. Hagstrom?
I'm doing well. It's remarkably also nice here.
Ah, and no doubt you haven't been out on your push bike either.
I have not. Actually, it's starting to get a little bit cool. Like I can tell that summer's about over, and also we're about to get rained on by a bunch of tropical storm-inspired rain, but today is nice.
Ah, excellent. And hiding somewhere up in the northern climes of Sweden is Jack Nutting. How are you, Jack?
I'm pretty good. Can't complain. Or as usual, I always say that, but of course I can complain.
I'm saving the complaining
for later.
Ah. I was going to correct you on a point of order there, but if it's all under control, that's excellent.
Yep.
Well, I was thinking about this, guys. I was reading an article about summer bites at the National Museum of Computing. And Australian Dr. Peter Thorne dropped in to see what was going on and catch up with some of the older computers and the projects going on, because he was involved in CYRAC. CYRAC being the first computer designed and built in Australia, and probably either the fourth or fifth in the world. And it came up in their conversation that what do they plan to do with it? Because we still have the entire computer, it's just it's currently in a non-working condition. But all 7 tons of it is still available. I'm not quite sure if it has visiting hours, but at least it's still all here. So CYRAC became operational in 1949. So it's good to have some old computing, but it came up in conversation that although it exists, it's expected that it's not going to ever be restored to working order, mainly because of the fact they'd have to replace or fix so much of the machine itself because of the technology used. And basically they were saying that if they repaired it, then it would be sort of a not original machine. And then when the engineers that could keep it currently going for the next, let's say, 10 years are around, but then after that, they'd have a non-working, non-original computer. So they've made the decision to just leave it as is so that it at least can be there as an artifact of the history of computing. So I was wondering, what is your preferred stance on machines? Are you somebody who likes to restore them to full operating condition, or do you like to modernize them? Do you like to work on them? Or is some of your kit so precious that you just leave it as is, that you don't want to get in and make it non-original? So, Paul, a collector of many machines, I suppose if you basically updated them all, you'd still be busy many lifetimes. But
right.
Where do you stand or sit on this?
Yeah, well, I was looking at the article. I hadn't read it before, you know, it showed up in our host topic, but they were saying that with all the you know, capacitors and so forth, that to put it in a working order, they'd have to make substantial changes, and then it would only stay working for a few years while the people who were around could still maintain it, and then it would stop being, you know, used again and stop working and be left in non-original condition. So I can sort of see the idea that it's not going to be long before it is just not going to work, period. So why alter it all now just to make it work for a little bit? I mean, I guess I find it a little hard to believe that it couldn't be kind of non-invasively fixed, you know, like maybe replace large chunks of it. Like if it's a power supply, you know, keep the old power supply and put the new power supply in.
Mm. Yeah, because it's built in a cabinet style, so it is actually built for servicing, as opposed to some of the earlier machines, which, you know, just a mass of componentry. This Cyrac was actually built in cabinet style, so that it could actually be easily serviced. But yeah, I agree that maybe they could make whole replacement units. Not necessarily all of them being component identical, but you know, if you've got, as I said, it's got a 300-volt power supply, I'm sure that they can arrange for another power supply. They've got the mercury delay lines, electrolytic capacitors.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose there's components throughout the entire machine that might be needing to be replaced, so it could be a major job, but several other institutions have embarked on recreating machines as close to the original as possible, but also satisfying current standards for electronic equipment.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if it is too, you know, like replacing things winds up just creating a big replica, then maybe it isn't that worth it. But one other point too about this, even if it is going to largely be dead, you know, pretty much for sure in 20 years or something. The one advantage of getting it running now, even if it is just temporary, is that we have now the ability to, you know, take videos of it and pictures of it and recordings of it and things that are much better than they would have been in you know, like the 50s. So rather than these old sort of like skippy black and white films, you know, we could actually see whatever it is. What is it now? 4K? Video of it, but I don't know. Yeah, it's a tricky question, because I'm sure it's not like an easy project or a cheap project. And I can understand their decision.
And the size of it needs quite a large area that you could actually move it to and then be working on it. So a major task. As much as I like bringing my machines up into more current standards, or even just getting them running, replacing parts. I suppose for what I'm doing, it really is just a power supply replacement, and at times just replacing capacitors. So you know, it's very small scale compared to what would be required for this. But I think I would like to have it there as original as possible. It's sad that it's non-working, but there are other things they can be doing to restore and to bring back the memories. But definitely, as you suggested, get in there with the video camera and do, you know, not necessarily a teardown of it, but you know, that what they can do, they can definitely take very high resolution video. They can get in and take great photography of it, so that, you know, it is digitally preserved as well as physically preserved. So Ken, I don't think you do too much on the hardware side, but do you have any thoughts on this?
I do. From my brief time working at Computer World magazine, I covered many Apple I auctions for them, as well as editor and reporter Greg Kaiser. He covered that beat as well. And one thing I saw often was debate over how much an Apple One was really worth when so many different parts had been replaced. They would promote a Apple One, they being the auction house, not Computer World, as being one of the few working condition Apple Ones in the world. But the way they got it to that state was by replacing some of the original parts. And so I have to question whether that makes it more valuable or less valuable. I suppose it depends on what the buyer is looking for, if they want something functional or something original. But I can see it going both ways. An Apple One that, you know, it was originally designed to be a computer, to be used by people. And if it's not functioning, then it's not serving that purpose. But it's been so long now that the Apple One is an artifact. It is not meant to be used as a computer anymore. People who have Apple Ones generally aren't sitting down using them every day. So in the case of something like that, I think I would rather have the original parts, and I can always fix it or upgrade it myself later if necessary. Once you throw away the original parts to replace it with working ones, you can't really go back.
No, no.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jack?
I think I'm leaning kind of in the other direction, that it's, if it's possible, if it's feasible and isn't going to cost a fortune or beyond what their budget is, like, I think it's reasonable to replace parts to make it work again. And I think we can look to other sort of vintage nostalgia fields, such as like classic cars. You know, if someone's got a, I don't know, a Ford Model T from 1919 or whatever, like a lot of stuff is likely changed out over the years or the past century. And I think people accept that as being, you know, that's fine, because that lets people today see what this thing kind of looked and sounded and smelled like at the time, right? But whereas if you had a thing that had all original parts, well, today it's just not going to run. It might be standing somewhere gathering dust and the leather all cracking on the seats and everything, but that's not going to be emulating the experience of what such a new car had been like when it was new. So I think that keeping something around and saying, well, we're not going to fix it because then it's not original anymore, doesn't necessarily do anybody much good. But I don't know. I don't have a strong, strong opinion about this. Mm. I just have kind of a weak inkling of an idea.
Yeah. Well, also being the only one, I think is another thing to take into consideration.
Mm.
We're not exactly awash with Apple Ones, but there's more than one. There will hopefully be original condition Apple Ones, or there will at least be original parts, non-working Apple Ones, as well as the ones that people have been working on. And as much as I would like to sit down and use an Apple One, as opposed to just looking at one behind Perspex, I would love the opportunity. But I think that there are replicas and other things out there that might give this a similar feel. But I would still love to have the opportunity to sit in front of a real Apple One and basically take it for a spin. As much as I would love to go and have a look at Cyrac and see it operating, but at least I still have the opportunity to go and physically look at it, which is something I should actually try and organize one of these days. But that's a few interesting viewpoints on that. So, dear listener, if you have any ideas or thoughts on what direction Cyrac should go, what your choice is in restoring your hardware, drop us a line at all the usual places. Okay, in listener feedback, Joseph sent in and asked if the RCR was going to do any video podcasting. Well, I don't know if we've got any immediate plans for doing any video podcasting, but in earlier days, we used to have Earl, David, and Carrington would use Google Hangouts, so we have some of those back in our archive and on the YouTube channel. But guys, any thoughts of being on video?
It is. I mean, one thing that is kind of cool about video is the ability to sort of, like, you know, hold up the thing and you know, people can actually see that I'm about to be crushed by mountains of old computer stuff. But I guess I know that my own podcast consumption is one that doesn't involve my focusing directly on the thing and doing nothing else, which is one thing that that video kind of requires. You know, I usually am listening to it in some environment where I'm on a public transit or something like that, and so I think if I were a consumer, I wouldn't be all that interested in video. I know if as an editor, I wouldn't be that interested in video. I think a video would have a lot more ums than what you're going to hear out of this. But I don't know. Anyone else?
Yeah, I've got a great face for radio.
Well, yeah, there's that, I suppose.
Yeah,
you have to.
It is something which has been tried. I won't say that it wasn't a rounding success, but it's different. I agree with Paul that I don't actually chase video podcasting. Now, there are a few YouTube channels that I watch, but it's mainly because they're of such detail that it's not the kind of thing that you can just listen to. I'm talking about highly visual shows such as the Ben Heck and his project work. It might be interesting to listen to a summary of what they're doing, but the half hour that you spend watching that show to me is not something that you could replicate. And then there's the talking heads. That's a different style. And to me, that's really just a audio podcast with pictures. And at least Carrington Earle and David did do quite a bit of, and here's what I'm talking about, and we're able to actually show it on camera. So like took it away from being the talking head type of video, which again, those that I have listened to, I don't necessarily watch because I don't feel that I'm missing any content. But again, that's just my consumption ideas, not what I would be looking at for this show.
I'm just jumping in there. I don't really watch any video podcasts either. That being said, I'd be open to us doing it if it's something that we could do reasonably simply and easily without placing any additional editing burden on anybody. If we could put something out there that is just sort of a simple recording that is just we let it be there raw, whereas the nicer fixed up audio version is the kind of the gold standard. The archive quality material, whereas right. The video is just sort of something that is kind of something we could throw together and let it be there for the extreme RCR fans. I don't know. Does that exist?
Mm-hmm. If I could mention, I think I might have been sort of casting it wrong the way they were doing it before, but I think essentially the idea of the previous Google Hangout thing was that it allowed people to kind of interact with the podcast as it happened,
So the audience participation. Yes.
Yeah. So it was still thought of as an audio podcast, but it was just sort of like if you wanted to be in on it while it was actually being recorded. So there was editing still. It was just as Jack was describing, it was kind of like, the cameras were there and there was a chat window that I participated in actually a bunch before I was on the show. But it was me and like four other people sometimes, right. in the chat window.
Yeah, that was I won't say it's the downside, but there was only a small number. I think the most I was ever participating in, again, same thing, I was participating in them before I actually joined the show, and I think there was about half a dozen in one episode, not counting the guys doing the show. Mm-hmm. But
and then they wouldn't actually even read it.
Carrington would pop up, and Michael said something about whatever it was 40 minutes ago. Oh well, bad luck.
Right.
If I can jump in, I want to draw on my experience actually hosting a video podcast 2 years ago. There was an audio edition as well. But the video edition was basically just two talking heads. I would talk and the screen would be my face. Then the person I was talking to would talk and the screen would be their face. And that didn't really contribute anything to the experience. Granted, it wasn't live, but I feel like even as archived material, it just wasn't very interesting. Video podcasts can be interesting, and I think it requires a more elaborate setup and more editing than we have. For example, if we were to actually be showing off the physical artifacts we're discussing, as opposed to just throwing up a blurry, jaggy JPEG, then that would be cool. Or if we had some sort of a cool background with all three of us on a screen at once, some sort of a split screen, that might be interesting. But the way Google Hangouts works, the way it automatically focuses on the person talking, I don't think makes for very interesting watching. And as Paul said, it demands your eyes, which means we're limiting our audience to people who aren't driving or cycling. Not that you should be listening to podcasts while cycling. Regardless, it needs your eyes. And I'm not a huge fan of video podcasts for that reason.
I think it's JPEG.
The creators... Ah, never mind.
Okay, so it's something we can think about and how we could integrate it into the show, maybe as some kind of video adjunct to the show, not necessarily the show itself. But yes, Joseph, thanks for reminding us of our video past, and we'll definitely be talking about it. So let's head on to the items of interest. So, Jack, you are threatening to go see the Retro Gathering.
Yes, I have a rare bit of actual Swedish retro news. There's an event called Retro Gathering coming up quite soon, 1st of October, in the Swedish town of Västerås, which, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, that does sound a lot like Westeros. There's a lot of speculation that Westeros, the continent, is named after Västerås, the town. Although, I don't know why you would name a continent after this little town. But regardless, anyway... this Retro Gathering is something that I have pretty much every year, it seems like for the past decade or something, I see it pop up in social media after it's happened. I see pictures of, oh, this thing and that thing, and I have missed it entirely. This year, I got a heads up in advance, and I'm actually planning on going. It's not in Stockholm, it's pretty near Stockholm, though. It's mostly a retro video game-themed event, but of course that includes all the standard 8-bit computers and things from the 80s. There are some themes going on. There are sort of exhibitions around certain themes, which are Castlevania, Sonic the Hedgehog, and something called Handic, which was actually that was the company in Sweden, as I understand, that was the distributor of the Commodore VIC-20 and C64. And they have things like an auction and the Swedish Masters in Pong will be declared. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to try my hand at the Pong. I don't think that I will win, but it sounds like fun. So, should be a good time. And, there is a link on their website to the English language page, which unfortunately is entirely out of date and is about the program from a year ago.
Well, but at least it gives you an idea of how it all goes. But no, it sounds very interesting. Mm-hmm. But you should enter the Pong Masters. I normally go into video competitions, game competitions, purely so that someone else doesn't come last. I believe it's my social duty. So,
take one for the team.
Yep.
Google Translate can kind of make it through this year's page.
Yeah, it probably gets most of it pretty well.
Ditch the Initiative Gaming Machines Act.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing.
Oh, it's a little bit of a political stuff.
Yeah, there's a little political thing there. So apparently, and I didn't know this until I read this on this website, things like pinball machines and arcade games in Sweden are regulated by the same laws that regulate digital gambling equipment. So if you want to have a slot machine or a video poker machine in your establishment, there are certain rules you have to follow, and there's like a gambling authority that has to give you a stamp of approval and stuff. And the same thing applies if you just want to put a pinball machine or a Pac-Man game, which kind of probably explains why I almost never see any of these things, any of these machines anywhere in Sweden, because it's apparently a pain in the neck. So,
well, I hope the Retro Gathering doesn't get raided.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd make the news.
Yeah, so anyway, so there's a bit of a political move to try and get the parliament to revisit this dumb old law and get rid of it. So we'll see.
Oh, good luck to them.
Yeah.
Yes, I can see there'd be a high level of interest amongst your parliamentarians for that.
Yeah, it's an important issue.
Yeah. Okay. Ken, you have some good news that the retro challenge is upon us.
Well, thanks for scooping me, Michael. Really appreciate it. I mean, we were already debating which of us should talk about this, and you said, oh, Ken, you can have it, but there you go. I'll add what little more I can. The Retro Challenge is a twice annual, I believe, programming competition. It's similar to Hackfest, which is held at Kansas Fest every year, except the rules and guidelines are much broader, as is the audience. For the Retro Challenge, you are challenged to take an entire month, in this case I believe is October, and program something cool for the retro computer of your choice, and then turn it in. The competition runs, as I said, October 1st to the 31st. The computer must be at least 10 years old, but they don't really want you running Windows XP, for example, because that's not really in the spirit of the thing. Gaming consoles and PDAs qualify if they were made in the previous century, and there are various other rules I'm reading on their website, which is retrochallenge.org. And then there are winners, and they get to choose from cool prizes. And among the organizers and judges are some people we all know and love, including Mr. John Linville, who was on whatever we called Chicken Missile at Kansas Fest 2015. Mm-hmm. And I believe we may even have a judge who has infiltrated the ranks of this very podcast we're listening to right now.
Shock horror.
Michael, it's you, isn't
it? Not it.
Yes.
So, Michael, you are one of the people who will be deciding the fates of millions who enter the Retro Challenge competition.
Yes, it's an arduous task, but yes, there will be millions upon millions of entries. So I think we have five so far. it's... used to be the winter warm-up and the summer retro challenge, but there was always a bit of tongue-in-cheek on the seasonal naming of those from us Southern Hemispherites. But it also seemed that the timing of those was inconvenient for a lot of people, so there was a bit of a poll, and they've decided to shift the two events so that they're at late different times of the year. So the one coming up is in October. So, yeah, as you said, get your retro computer of choice, pick a project. Doesn't necessarily have to be programming. People in the past have done things like, I'm going to use a Newton PDA for a month in place of what I currently do. There are others who are going to be doing restorations in previous years, and even hardware development, because with a whole month you can get a lot more done. But still, there is always that last rush for the line at the end of the month. So really looking forward to reviewing the entries and working with John to declare the winners.
Great news story, Michael. Thanks.
I definitely like it better in October. I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to do anything more in October than in July, but July was terrible for me. I mean, just partly because it was always Kansas Fest taking up like the second half. So.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was basically my excuse for the last few years, and before then, I think it was just general apathy. Yeah. But the summer one, which for us, it was the summer one, the winter warm-up one, being around the Christmas was a little bit difficult for me, holiday-wise, family-wise. But no, I quite like the realignment. So,
so when is the other one? Do you know?
Oh, that would be earlier in the year. I believe it's going to be April.
Okay, excellent.
But that'll be advertised later on. It's all just been a little bit up in the air. So John's actually taking over as the man of the moment for this time round, and hopefully he'll warm to the challenge and quite enjoy corralling and getting all these people through to the end of the month. And we'll see him line up to do it again in 6 months' time. So. A very interesting time ahead.
Excellent. Maybe also just worth, Ken mentioned that he was part of the big mega podcast.
Yes.
At last year's Kansas Fest. He's one of the hosts of the Coco Crew podcast.
Yes.
With Neil Blanchard.
Okay. Well, we talked about Cyrac earlier in the show, and Cyrac also was one of the first computers to have a built-in speaker. Now, that was to be used for alert tones and other warnings, I suppose. But, of course, when you've got a computer with a speaker and the ability to toggle the speaker, of course, from within the computer, men and women's minds turn to music. So we have here an article from the Australian Geographic, which is republished, but it is how Australia played the world's first music on a computer. As well as the article, we also have some YouTube videos, one of them by one of the programmers involved in setting it up, and another YouTube video on Cyrac itself, but at 3 minutes and 30 seconds in, actually starts to talk about the musical process involved. So I think it is great that we actually have recreated audio from this. So I should mention that at the end of the Australian Geographic article, there is actually download links for some of the music that was played on Cyrac. So you too will be able to have some real dance music or not, that you can play on your phones or iPods.
I thought I saw someone saying it sounded like a kazoo or something like that.
Yeah, I think the tissue paper over a comb sort of music. Yes, but it wasn't intended to play music. Everything was there. All you needed was a program to do it, and I think that's it's quite good. We all used to play with very basic music creation on our earlier machines. Some retro computerists had the advantages of far, far better music capability on their machines than others, but I don't think we'll quite get into that discussion. But it was definitely more challenging on the Apple II.
Builds character.
Yeah, it builds character. So any thoughts? Does it bring back memories of toggling speakers to try and make something which, if you sort of try real hard, sounds like music?
Well, I know I did some of that kind of stuff, not knowing really anything about like waveforms and music and that kind of stuff. Just sort of like, I think I spent a while trying to do two-voice music, you know, because when you don't know anything about waveforms and speakers, you think, oh, this should be possible.
Mm. And then it just sounds like so much static.
Oh yeah, it was beyond me, but it was kind of fun to do, but I can appreciate trying to deal with such primitive tools. There was one I think it was maybe like an Altair or something that you could actually play music by, like there was something that they played with it such that the interference pattern that it, you know, the electromagnetic interference that it put out, could play music on a speaker nearby. I'm trying to remember now what that was,
I remember, yes, that, but I can't remember the machine that they were doing it to.
Mm-hmm.
Wireless audio.
Yeah, right. Very cool, though.
Oh, they should have patented and taken Apple to task with AirPlay. Okay. Paul, you've got something about one of my favorite subjects.
Yeah, I don't understand how we suddenly turned into like the Apollo Guidance Computer Roundtable, but there seems to just repeatedly be like new stories about it. But so this time published on August 31st, so really, really just recently, Gadget in South Africa, I think, posted something about the hacker, the scrap heap, and the first Apollo computer. And what the story is basically this guy. He kind of became interested in the Apollo Guidance Computer and at some point got photos from somebody in Texas of the memory modules that the program was on, and did a bunch of sleuthing and tracked it down and found someone who had kind of hidden himself away, but who had basically gotten many parts of the Apollo Guidance Computer from like a scrap heap 40 years ago. And I think he had tried to sell a little bit of it at one point, and the FBI visited and said, like, where'd you get all this stuff? I think he had a receipt or something like that. Like, the FBI went away without incident, but he kind of, like, became a hermit after that. And so the guy who, you know, sort of the subject of the story, Francois Rautenbach, I suppose, he tracked this guy down. So Francois is not the guy who bought all the stuff from the scrap heap, but he found the guy who did and managed to borrow it. I think he put down a deposit and borrowed it. And so he has a number, maybe all of the Apollo rope memory modules, and he set up a reader, and he's got some YouTube videos of him like reading it off and some other discussions of like what's in there. And I have not watched all of the videos yet, but it's pretty wild. So like what I have seen is interesting, and what I will soon see, I anticipate will also be interesting. But he's basically just reading out the program, which I, from what I understand, was not around. I mean, like, this is preserving something that wasn't preserved. So I think it may predate the Apollo 11 program a bit, but that's also, you know, I mean, that's interesting too. So anyway, I'm looking forward to reading this. I don't know much more than I have said now, but there's a YouTube channel that has at least at this point, I think, three related things on the Apollo guidance computer parts, and I think one of them is largely just one of those MIT news things about how they were sewn together and stuff like that. And then there's also a couple of videos of his dog talking, but that's, I think, something different. So take a look, as I will.
Oh, yeah, definitely going to be watching these. But yeah, just the thought of reading off the stored program off these memory cartridges, basically, is such a fascinating thing that after all this time that they've been recovered, and then being able to read the data off them is great, because, you know, in a lot of cases, this hasn't been, as you said, archived in any way, and now it has been rescued. Is excellent.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Okay. Oh, Jack, you spoil me. One of my favorite games, and it's being remade.
It's a good one.
Tell me more.
HTML5 remake of LoadRunner. You can run LoadRunner right in the browser. No plugins, no nonsense, just good old LoadRunner. They have a bunch of different game modes and different game versions. They have Classic LoadRunner, Professional LoadRunner, Revenge of LoadRunner, the LoadRunner
Professional
fanbook.
LoadRunner.
I consider myself
hopefully not Arcade LoadRunner. Machine LoadRunner.
Championship LoadRunner. So there's a whole bunch of things, and this is obviously on the web, and it's also therefore automatically sort of open source, but they also have the source code on GitHub for handiness. So pretty cool. I've played it a little bit. It seems to me very, very like the original, and I like it. It's nice that there's no need for any kind of emulator or anything. You just sort of, there it is in the browser. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, when I was a guest on the New Game Plus podcast earlier this year, remember, they're the guys who told us about the LoadRunner board game. I think that's the way many of them played the game, because it was just so easy. These are podcasters who are in their mid-20s. They never had an Apple II growing up, and just being able to go to a URL was much easier than installing an emulator, buying a Nintendo cartridge off eBay or whatever. I'm sure LoadRunner is in the Internet Archive, and you can just plug and play, but that wasn't really natively designed for that experience, whereas the HTML5 one that you're talking about, Jack, is. It's just easier.
It is so faithful, though.
Yeah, it's very faithful. But despite that, it's also open source. So if you want, you can just grab it and make your own changes to it, and probably relatively easily make levels and do whatever you want to do. So it seems nice.
Well, it might actually... I mean, LoadRunner came with a level editor, which is one of the things that was cool about it. So I think it probably has level editors right in it without the source.
That's true. It does have that too. And I don't know how new this actually is. I first saw this in the past couple of weeks, which is why I tossed it in here. But it may have been around for a while. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it before a couple weeks ago either, but I had the same impression, like, how did I miss this?
I think it's been around for a while. I've saw it sometime in the last year, but I don't know exactly when. I'm looking in the Wayback Machine to see if they have it. Looks like it dates back to January of 2015.
Okay.
Wow.
Well, if it's been around for a while, I think it's time to give it a little bit more exposure, because it well and truly deserves. Lode Runner, one of my favorite arcade games of all time.
So, no argument here.
Yeah. This one's going to the bookmark bar right on the top of my browser.
Oh, and actually, wait. While I'm on this favorite game business, I need to mention my old favorite game, Jumpman, which was not big on the Apple II, I know, but was big on the Atari and on the Commodore 64. As everyone knows, since my talking about it earlier, there is, what did the guys make? They made the tool called Omnivore, made mm-hmm. by a couple of our friendly Atari nerds, which is a way of sort of reverse engineering Atari binaries, and they've added into Omnivore a direct level editor for Jumpman, and they're running right now a contest for creating your own Jumpman levels. So all you have to do is fire up the Omnivore tool, and Kevin Savitz has posted a video showing how this works, and yeah, seems pretty cool. The contest runs until October 22nd. You could actually combine this and the retro challenge. That's going to be my retro challenge, is making a Jumpman level.
Excellent.
That's it.
And I have something to jump in with here, too. I did a random search on, you know, so I don't know exactly how reliable the results are, but I found a timeline of 1-bit music, 1949 to 1979, on the 1-bit forum. And so the question had come up, you know, like, what was this RFI music thing? And apparently it was actually, this was not new to the Altair. So the UNIVAC 1052 was programmed to play Ebb Tide with RFI. There was an Altair 8080, one in 1974, and another one on the 8800 in 1975 that was demonstrated to the Homebrew Computer Club, and that was probably the one that I had heard about before. But there's a four-voice RFI music player for the PDP-8 in 1975 also, so apparently lots of people had this idea.
Mm. More beautiful music. Well, yes. Music. Well, vaguely music. Okay. Well,
there's more anyway.
There's more. So, Ken, we've got some more creative avenues to explore. What have you got for us?
That's right. This is the best of the Retro Challenge, which is classic gaming, and Lode Runner, which is new gaming. It is the Interactive Fiction Technology Foundation. This is a brand new 501c3 nonprofit founded this summer here in Massachusetts to support the community and development of new interactive fiction, IF, also known as text adventures. There is a lively modern text adventure community, people who are still creating and making these games. Now, we on the Apple II may know them from Amon, which was a very expandable game development environment for text adventures. There's an entire Amon Adventurers Guild online where you can find all those old games. What's the name of their URL? Is it still Amon AG? Yeah, amonag.org, exactly. But most text adventures nowadays are being made in cross-platform systems, the most popular ones being Inform and Twine. Twine games actually are played right in your web browser. You don't need any sort of an interpreter for it. I don't think that's the case for Inform, but I would need to double-check that. I do recall that Wade Clark, who created Leadlight, which was on the cover of Juice GS 5 years ago, has ported Leadlight to Inform, and it can now be played locally. I, in fact, had him on my IndieCider podcast last summer to talk about his Inform port. However, back to the main topic, the Interactive Fiction Technology Foundation, the IFTF, want to encourage more such creations, so they have collaborated with the organizers of the Interactive Fiction Competition, the deadline for entry for which was just this past week. It is an annual competition and is now being run under the auspices of the IFTF. There's also the Interactive Fiction Archive, found at ifarchive.org, and the IFTF will be helping them to modernize and expand their database of all IF games. And they are also available to assist with any sort of legal matters that you may encounter as you create games, any sort of a community or architectural support that you need. They do not do funding directly. They are not an alternative or a competitor to Kickstarter or Patreon, but they are a pretty robust organization with an active board of luminaries, such as Chris Klimas is the creator of Twine, one of those systems that I just mentioned. Carolyn Van Esseltine, who is currently working on the Kickstarter-funded successor to the Quest for Glory series, I believe. Andrew Plotkin, who did Hadean Lands, which is one of the first Kickstarter-backed games, I believe. He appeared in Get Lamp, Jason Scott's documentary. And so a whole bunch of pretty accomplished individuals. Their advisory board includes, for example, Nick Montfort at MIT, who has a huge video game archive and wrote the book Twisty Little Passages. Mm-hmm. Or Professor Brian Moriarty, who is now at WPI, Professor Moriarty, who used to work for... Infocom, sorry. Wow.
Oh, did he?
Yes. Yes.
I was going to point out that Cambridge is actually a really great place for this to be based, because Infocom was based there, Trillium, Telerium was based there, Spinnaker was based there. So, I mean, Cambridge is, you know, IF home.
Yeah, I don't think that's a coincidence. Specifically, Brian Moriarty worked on Wishbringer, Trinity, and Loom. He's now a professor at my alma mater. The IFTF is really well-rooted. This is not just some fly-by-night, oh, let's help some people and see what we can do, and oh, we weren't preparing for this to be so complicated, now we're out of money. No, these guys all know what they're doing. They're really good at interactive fiction. And so I'm really excited to see them join forces and by their powers combined be the Interactive Fiction Technology Foundation. You can find them at iftechfoundation.org. And I also did an interview with Chris Klimas, the creator of Twine and one of the co-founders and co-directors, on my Polygamer podcast, because text adventures are a very accessible means of game development. You don't have to go to school for it. You don't have to learn C++ or Unity or pay a license for an expensive tool. It enables anybody to become a game creator. It really democratizes that process. And I think it's great that there's an organization to support that process. The end.
Excellent. Very cool.
Yeah, I love how the text adventures are still going strong, and they're just I'm just always amazed at the creativity and the strong plot lines and the great storytelling that is coming up in these modern day ones. It's just excellent. Just that this as a medium is still out there.
Yeah, I'm pleased that it's so close to me, you know, physically. I'm curious to see if they have any events that I can actually go to.
But. I think historically they've had meetups at PAX East. I don't know if they still do that. They did when the event was founded. I thought that there was some sort of an interactive fiction meetup in Boston.
There might be. I've never looked.
Yeah, it's called the People's Republic of Interactive Fiction. You can find them at pr-if.org. And their next meetup is Wednesday, September 28th, 6:30 p.m. at MIT. It's a monthly event.
Excellent. So for that large proportion of our listeners who are in the area. But yeah, cool. Thanks.
Okay. Well, continue along the line of computers doing music. We had an interesting item pop up in our Facebook group, which is more along the lines of music doing computers. So Jonathan has in his collection an LP, Mainframe, MC Squared Records, and it's got four tracks on it, Apple II, ZX81, Spectrum, and BBC. So he put that up there, and then we've got Ian's basically replied back with some information on LPs that included computer programs. So that was really early multimedia. It was a way of the record companies trying to get some extra content onto the LPs that wasn't available on radio for people to record, I suppose. But it was really just, I suppose, just an alternate marketing method. So the interesting link is to vinyl data on Kemper.com. So it gives a timeline of programs on LPs. So if you want to find out a little bit more about that, that's a great link to follow on to. So really, kind of make LPs the random access storage method for audio programs. Rather than having to run through your tape to the right point, you can just pick up the arm of your player and drop it onto the right track. So
yeah, that's pretty cool. It was pretty cool reading about the you know, all the like the 80s bands or whatever that had like terrible games on there somewhere on there, like B-sides or something.
And some of the content didn't really get that much better when they started doing it onto the early CDs either. But no, it was something which I actually wasn't aware of that, you know, should have dawned on me. You know, we've got programs that load in off cassette. Why wouldn't it be a track on vinyl as well? But it just hadn't clicked to me on that. I was not aware of it at all, that these things were available on vinyl along with the audio that they were wanting to release. And there's quite some interesting ones in here, so it's definitely worth a read, and I'm going to have to resist strongly the urge to open up another section of my collection.
Yeah, I have a couple of these Interface Age magazines that came with a flexi disc in them too, which is that's pretty cool. You know, like actually just in the pages of the magazine. Steve Wyrick, sometimes member of this roundtable, posted a little comment in there that linked to a Wikipedia article in that as well, that shows a little picture of the flexi disc in the pages of the magazine.
Excellent. It's also great that we're now reaching that level of people on the Facebook group that were able to, you know, pop in little items like this, get some information back from others, as well as a great place to post pictures of interesting items in your collections. So I'm very glad that Jonathan popped this one in there. It was quite an interesting little article that came up out of it as far as the Kempler link.
So has anyone used 8-tracks? Seems like that's the next logical step, right? If we have cassettes and records.
No, I don't have an 8-track player, so okay, hardware to go with.
Retro challenge.
Release a new program on 8-track. Yes.
Were there like home consumer recorders for 8-track tapes? Could you record an 8-track tape actually, or was it pretty much just play only? You just bought them done.
Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing, but
because I only actually remember in my childhood ever seeing them in a car. Like you have an 8-track tape player in the car to listen to music. I don't know how you would record one.
Yeah, about all I could offer would be to put a program onto a reel-to-reel and then play it back into a computer. Don't have actually, I don't know if there ever was a home 8-track recorder. You're right. But yeah, it's just one of those interesting collisions of media. So
yes, really obsolete on many levels.
Yeah. Yeah. So hopefully Jonathan can post back. He said he was going to schedule in to record those and post the files back up. So hopefully he can find the time to do that. It would be excellent. Okay. Paul, what is a cloud tea?
So yeah, the what's the guy's name? John H on the Model 100 mailing list had posted that he, you know, sort of had just finished up what I think is a like a JavaScript TRS-80 Model 100 emulator. So what's cool about this is that it, it's, you know, it runs on in a web page, and so you can use it on your phone, for example. And I haven't played around with it very much. I've just kind of launched it. But, you know, you can use the cursor keys. You can start editing a text file. It looks pretty nice. And so there's another kind of like standalone emulator that you can get called Virtual T that, you know, I think probably is more mature, but the idea basically of just being able to do this in the web browser is pretty cool, and you know, being able to use your Model 100 on the train or whatever. So anyway, I just wanted to point out, I guess, that exists, and it's a very, very cool development that I don't think anyone, you know, except for John himself, knew was coming. So that's that was kind of neat. That was it. Short story.
So, Ken, you've got some great news about Sierra Classics.
Yeah, because I haven't talked enough about games on this episode, I want to briefly mention that Steam, which is a marketplace for games on PC, Mac, and Linux, has added several classic games from Sierra Online. This is not the first time they've added Sierra titles. For example, you can get pretty much the entire King's Quest series on there. But now they've added many more, including at least one Apple II game. They have now the entire Police Quest collection, Gabriel Knight and Gabriel Knight 2 and 3, Arcanum, the entire Quest for Glory collection, Phantasmagoria 1 and 2, and Caesar 3 and 4. Now, if, like me, you are almost exclusively a classic Apple II gamer, then not all those will be recognizable, but many of these games were huge titles in the 80s and 90s. So to have these readily available on Steam, you just go online and Quest for Glory 1 through 5, for example, all five games are exactly $10. That's a steal, $2 a game, and they've been updated to run in a modern computer environment. No emulator or jury-rigging necessary. The only downside is that all the games I just mentioned have been added to Steam for Windows only. Most Steam games, in my experience, run on Windows, Mac, and Linux, and these games have been created for Windows only, so that's kind of a bummer. I also don't know exactly what version of these games they are porting. For example, Police Quest, is it the Apple II version? I think not. It's probably going to be the DOS version, I presume. But nonetheless, if you want to play some of these classic games easily and affordably on your Windows machine, you can check it out on Steam. Anybody here grow up with any of these titles?
I think I just missed most of them.
Mm.
Like, I sort of stopped just before them.
Yeah, me too. I feel like they're just after my prime video gaming time as a kid.
Yep. So same here. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, they were mostly not my cup of tea because they were mostly, even back then, Windows machines, and I was an Apple II guy. I did love Space Quest and King's Quest, but both of those series are already available on Steam. You can get the entire Space Quest series for $20. But again, it's Windows only, so that doesn't do me any good.
Mm-hmm.
Were you going to ask me something, Paul?
Well, I was. So it's possible that this is a too big of a tangent, but what? So there's also this goodoldgames.com site, which is, you know, GOG.com, where it seems like it's kind of a competitor to Steam, and it has a lot of these old games, often ported from Windows, but, you know, and often only available on Windows. But one difference, I think, is that these are DRM-free. So I don't know how Steam works too well, but I believe there's a lot of phoning home that happens, and, you know, Steam still needing to exist and that sort of thing if you get a Steam game. So I'm wondering, what do you think of... This is, you know, as I say, kind of a tangent, but GOG or Good Old Games or whatever they go by, GOG versus Steam.
Yeah, I think they have officially become GOG, kind of like Kentucky Fried Chicken has become KFC. But I haven't used GOG all that much. They do have, for example, the Police Quest series for Windows only for $10, so there's no difference there. I think the reason Steam phones home is because it has more social features. Like, I don't think on GOG, for example, you can befriend other gamers and compare your scores and earn achievements by performing especially well in certain games. I'm not really sure because I don't have that much experience with GOG. As far as DRM goes, I have not had a problem playing Steam games offline, like when I am in mid-flight and I haven't paid for the in-flight Wi-Fi. But even if there is DRM, it does not exist in a way that has affected my gameplay experience. And since Steam generally has a lot more games and the prices are the same, but my friends are all on Steam, that right. tends to be where I go. Kind of like the reason everybody uses Facebook is because everybody else uses Facebook.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So I don't have a problem with Steam, but you are bringing up a good point that it's worth your while to shop around. The libraries between the two platforms are not identical, and there may be a sale on one and not on the other. So if you're looking for a game, check them out on both and pick the one that you like.
And maybe we can find out what the DRM situation is, because I suspect on Steam, at some point they will say, all right, it's been too long since I've called home. I need to call home now. But it's good that they at least do work on, you know, limited term at least, offline usages. I guess I just worry, you know, I just worry about the future. Like, since we're talking about vintage stuff already, you know, in 10 years' time when Steam is gone, you know, and.
For what it's worth, I just did a quick Google search and found a news story from just this past June, 3 months ago, of a utility called GOG Connect. It is an official tool released by GOG. Mm-hmm. Which basically says that you log into your GOG account, and then you supply your Steam credentials, and any Steam games you already own that GOG also carries, you'll automatically get, for free, DRM-free.
That's cool and ingenious. I like it.
It does say it only works on certain games, so it's not the full libraries of the two, but still, I mean, free is free.
Yeah, nice. Okay, cool. We'll have to put a link in the show notes so that I can find it.
Okay. Well, I think that wraps up our news for this episode. So here's a video message.
This is the computer Cyrac. It was the first fully automatic electronic digital computer to be built in Australia. It was constructed in the radio physics division of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation to the designs of Mr. Trevor Pearcey and Mr. Maston Beard. Mr. Pearcey was responsible for the logical design of the circuitry, and Mr. Beard engineered the electronic components. This computer is of advanced electronic design for its day, and it has a very flexible command code.
In 1948, the division undertook the study of automatic digital computing, and in 1951, CIRAC, this machine, was actually exhibited publicly in operating order, and has since then been in regular service for the best part of a period of 13 years. During some of this time, it has been improved, and during the last 9 years of its life, has been used as a teaching and research machine in the University of Melbourne. The main store of CIRAC and most of the incidental registers consists of a number of acoustic delay lines. These take the form, usually, of pipes containing mercury, each one about 5 feet long, down which acoustic waves travel, taking a time of about 1 millisecond. When they reach the far end of the pipe, they are detected, amplified, and recirculated to the starting point. By this means, CIRAC was able to store 756 items of data, that is 6 decimal digit items or the equivalent, and to be able to operate upon them 1,000 times a second.
We're going to feed the tape now into CIRAC, and I press the appropriate control buttons on the console, and the tape is inched forward until we position it into the buffer register at the right spot. Now the bootstrap tape is going in and the tape is moving into the reader. You can actually see it go into the memory, filling up the cells of the memory by switching on the console keyboard. We can see the tape in position in store. It's loaded into the memory, and we now set the data for the problem, and I am setting this on the keyboard registers. This is the numbers that have to be fed to the program. I fed that number into the machine, and now the next number goes in, and I start the button here, and the calculations take place, and you'll see the results coming out on punch paper tape from the paper tape punch at this stage. Now, we're putting the results from that calculation into the Flexoriter, which is going to print out the results for us. And we feed it into the reading device here. And we press the start read here, and the tape will run into the Flexoriter, and the printing of the codes on the tape now takes place.
I have said that CYRAC was easy to use. Let me illustrate by mentioning a few points of its design. From the operator's point of view, the display of the operations is comprehensive and convenient. The state of the store and the arithmetical registers were shown as arrays of spots or traces on small cathode ray tubes, and the state of the control system was made visible as rows of lights on the panels in front of the control console. A switchboard provided facilities for manual control of a program and for insertion of requisite data while the program was running, other than the data which was provided on the punched paper tapes.
Well, that is the story of CYRAC. This machine, which is still in operation, is perhaps the oldest at present in the world. And it is fitting that this machine is to be stored in the Applied Science section of the National Museum. It will be a historic exhibit, and lots of people in the future should gain much information about early days in computing from the presence of CYRAC in the museum.
I felt alone and isolated. Sure, email and social media are great, but I wanted something more. Something in real time with real people. I was in a rut with the same old routine. Then my doctor told me about CocoFest.
CocoFest, held in Lombard, Illinois, is proven to help people break their routine and increase the enjoyment of their computer hobby.
It was important to me that CocoFest didn't involve harsh chemicals. The fact that it reduced my feelings of isolation helped get me that confidence to participate in the Coco community.
Some people had changes in behavior, thinking, mood, innovative and beneficial thoughts or actions during or after CocoFest. If you notice any of these, contact others right away. Tell others about any history of mental health improvement which will likely accelerate while attending CocoFest. Use caution when operating vintage computing machinery. Common side effects include trouble sleeping, feelings of anticipation, joystick thumb, and increased levels of vintage computing activity.
I'm very proud. I love myself as a CocoFest attendee.
Ask your doctor if CocoFest is right for you.
And we're back. Okay, it's time for the retro computing gift idea. This time I found something, it's a little bit on the pricey side, but I just can't resist it for its looks and what it can be used for. So what we have here is the QWERTY Writer. So it is a old-style typewriter keyboard, but it's only done in the style of a typewriter. So start with, you don't have the masses of hardware on the disk. It says it's a Bluetooth or wireless, and it has a built-in stand that you can use for any standard tablet. And there's also a picture of it in front of a computer screen. So in this case, an iMac, but you can have a wonderful retro keyboard experience by the look of it with the QWERTY Writer from QWERTY Toys. Currently on special for $329, normally $399. So I can't see me rushing out to buy it, but I can just look at the pics. It looks to be a superb piece of hardware. If it was just a little bit cheaper, I'd probably buy it. But at the moment, I shall just have to admire it.
It is beautiful.
Mm.
And it has a return bar, which it says that you can, you know, it would normally actually just serve as an enter key, but you can actually set it as a macro as well.
I just think that's excellent. So I probably would just use it as a return key, just to get back to the old typewriter days.
Yeah, it's styled like one of the actual manual typewriters, even though, you know, like you don't actually have to mash on the keys.
And no hammers are going to come up and type onto your tablet. So your iPad.
That's a mistake you make once. Only once.
But as far as hardware goes, this appears to be very well put together, very well styled. I would love to have a go at one of these. But that's why it's a gift idea. Someone can rush out and send it to me.
Yeah, I think actually, and you know, speaking of the expense, I think the table that we suggested last time was more. And
that'd be perfect. Oh, could you imagine just that pedestal table and this? Now that would be such a wonderful retro computing experience.
Be perfect. But ever since then, I keep getting sidebar ads for this table.
I've noticed that too. The cookies are getting a little bit more invasive.
Yeah.
Well, and moving right along, we'll move into our eBay auction picks. So, starting with Jack, Enterprise 128. So this is a new Star Trek offering?
Oh, if only. No, this is the Enterprise 128 vintage computer. I'd never heard of this. There was apparently an Enterprise 64 that came out shortly before this, and you can guess what those numbers are. There's the amount of RAM in these things, of course. It was an English company who made this. The company was called Intelligent Software, and it was marketed by Enterprise Computers. Apparently, a lot of these ended up in Eastern Europe. They were popular in Hungary. So this was sort of an early 80s plug-into-your-television kind of computer. Seems to have okay color graphics. This particular one that's on sale, or is for sale, it looks very, very clean and fresh. It says it's in the box. It's probably been kept in this box quite a bit. It looks like it's in good shape. One of the funky things about this computer is that in the spot where you might expect to find arrow keys, there is instead a joystick that looks kind of like a miniaturized version of the classic Atari joystick, with the sort of concentric circles surrounding the stick itself.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen this or heard of this before, but I stumbled across it on eBay, and it looks interesting.
Not only is the hardware in good condition, but apart from a little bit of corner damage, the box seems to be in good condition as well. But no, I've never heard of this manufacturer or this model before. So nice find.
Yep, pretty interesting. One thing that got me a little bit laughing when I saw the box is that on the top of the box, the closed box, at the bottom there's some text that says, "With obsolescence built," and then there's like a specular highlight in the box. You can't see the final word. I was wondering if it actually said "with obsolescence built in," but no. Apparently, I googled and found that it does say "with obsolescence built out," which is
there's a bit of a light flare there on that corner, which obsolescence built.
Built something.
it's really like I like the look of it though. I mean, it's the colorful keyboard and the little joystick is possibly something you could injure yourself on while typing quickly, but otherwise it's pretty cool. I like it.
Yeah, it seems.
I had heard of these once before, and I thought we talked about this once, and I went and checked. And it was apparently in March 2014, so I have no sense of the passage of time. but none of you were on that. It was my eBay pick from way back then. So I had come across them once before, but I have ever since then had an eBay search on them. So just in case one became available that wasn't, approximately $245 US.
Right. Yeah, this one is pretty pricey, and it is being sold from Budapest, so shipping from Hungary to the U.S. is probably pretty expensive also. But, if it's something that someone's been looking for, this looks like a very nice condition to have one in. I can't say if the price is good or not, but...
I'd love to have this. This is very cool. I'm going to continue to look for these.
Yep.
Okay, well... Just a few quick little items for me. So of course, I couldn't resist sort of trying to find out what else for computers is out there on vinyl. So we've all been familiar with the audio cassette learning systems for various computers. So of course there's going to be one out there on vinyl. So here's one on home computers. Unfortunately, the booklet that came with the LP is not included in here. They basically say it's missing. But there's a very 70s/80s photo of a family in front of their computer, and this is the audio that goes with the introduction to everything you wanted to know about home computers. Slightly more interesting is the next one. It's music by an IBM 7090. Now, this audio is also available in YouTube, so just search for the IBM 7090 in YouTube and you'll be able to listen to the album. But if you want the full vinyl experience, only £24.99, or for me, $44. It's quite a good disc, and the music is a lot better than what I'm familiar with from my old Apple II days. And not quite an LP, but still physical media from our friends at 8-Bit Weapon is Silo 64. Now, I've checked on their website store. They've currently got it that it's out of print. It's not available, so you'll need to pick it up off on eBay. So here's one of their CDs done in a 5 1/4-inch floppy disk style. So quite an interesting bit. I love my music from 8-Bit Weapon. So if you will include a link to 8-Bit Weapon. So if you haven't been listening to them, take the opportunity to pop over and have a listen to what they've got to offer. Quite reasonable prices for their music. That was my little journey through eBay for computers meet music, or music meets computers.
And while you were talking, I stuck a couple extra things under your name there, because it reminded me. So I don't know, this maybe I'll just very brief quick plug of a sort, but on Drop 3 Inches, Mike and I talked a little bit about this The Greatest Baseball Game Never Played, which was a radio broadcast, but you can buy it on LP, on vinyl, and basically it was an Apple III simulating the, you know, it was doing a sort of like a role-playing baseball game with a sort of like all-star players, both alive and dead at the time, and, you know, like just what would happen if these teams were matched up, and so the Apple III was responsible for actually like determining like, you know, how the pitches went and all that, and then it was called as if it were real.
Okay, so it basically supplied the game in motion, and then it was actually, as you said, professionally presented as a game being played in real time.
Yeah, it was pretty goofy, but the record itself has a little bit of a description of how the program was set up by the programmer and stuff. So, and then, you know, the baseball whatever is boring, so I didn't listen to the rest, but sort of computer related.
Oh, well,
and a chance to plug the podcast.
And a good plug. But yeah, it's just, I just love going for a bit of a trawl through eBay. It's just you get an idea in your head and just jump in there and you see what's available. And yes, it normally is. Yeah. So, Paul, what did you find in your little foray into eBay?
Well, let's see. The first thing I found, I should know more about this, but I don't. But there is an Auric 1. 48K Auric 1 setup in very good working order condition in the UK, in Yorkshire. So most of these are usually there because I think this was they were to some extent popular in at least Europe, if maybe Britain specifically. But at any rate, this is, it has a reserve, and I don't know what it is going to actually be. The starting bid is basically 10 British pounds. So it's going to go for whatever the market is. It's a little bit, it's kind of, it's like maybe sort of a step up from the Sinclair, you know, it's a little bit like the, what do you call it? The mini color computer,
the Spectrum,
but the MC10 or whatever,
yeah.
But yeah, so this is a nice, you know, so it's that kind of shape. You know, it's basically just big enough to be a chiclet keyboard. But it comes with a bunch of software, some user group newsletters. It's shown working. So it looks pretty cool. I kind of would like to get one of these. I sort of keep an eye out for them, but they're always, the shipping's always relatively bad for me. So I'm trying to remember. Maybe I can quickly even look this up.
This one's got shipping at £20, so it's about $25 US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not bad. And I was just, I thought I was right about this. It's a 6502 machine. So that's also a selling point for me because I already kind of know its language. So so someday. But I think, well, I don't know. We'll see. If nobody bids on this until the very end, it's not impossible. I will bid on it. But it's a very nice, one, and I'm sure someone's going to notice this. I think it was only listed earlier today. Anyone have any experience with the Auric?
No, that's another one I was aware of, but never even seen one in the plastic.
Mm-hmm. Whenever I see it, I understand it's Auric, but I just can't not think of it as Auric from Blake 7.
Yep. Yes, one of the better characters from Blake 7.
Yes. Yeah, that was a show that was full of a lot of sort of like, I don't know, grumpy sarcasm. Auric was particularly good with this, but his name is.
I like grumpy sarcasm.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so at some point I will get an Auric. But and the other one is, so I didn't find this myself, actually. This was posted on the Facebook group by Brian. This is an Ace Discovery 500, which is, I think it's an S100 machine, but it's, at any rate, it's, you know, it runs CPM of various flavors. And it is from Action Computer Enterprise, Inc. I don't think there were very many of these actually out there in the world, but this one looks like it's in pretty good shape. A Discovery 500 multiprocessor. The auction says that it's been basically in storage for most of the time since the 80s when the seller bought it from a retired electronics engineer. And 15 years ago, it was started up and worked. It has like a C compiler you can use, and, you know, runs CPM of various sorts. It's right now, it is listed as pickup only in Phoenix, Arizona. It's conceivable from the way this is worded that you might be able to talk the seller into shipping it. But the seller says this is, I have no idea what it weighs, but it's heavier than any other computer I have ever picked up. This is obviously somebody who did not live through Big Iron, but
no.
At any rate.
From the looks of the pictures, it's going to be quite a weighty device. I just love all the blue ribbon cable going across, connecting it all up. So it looks very S100. In that regard, but yes, it's probably not going to be the heaviest computer I would ever have picked up and moved, but it's definitely one where you want to sort of like hold it close to the torso, bend the knees.
But it does really look like it's in good shape.
Yeah,
I mean,
so
if you're near Phoenix,
go
get
for
this thing. It's the starting bid is $50. So
looks in good condition. It's a shame that no shots of it working, if it is working, but it's some very good condition hardware from back in the day.
There are some. There's a couple of pictures of it.
There we are. Yep, there's some extra photos there. Yep.
Yeah.
Ooh,
yep.
Nice.
Well, the front light is on, and it says, you know, system IPL from SASE hard, or enter IPL override code, suggesting to me that it's not starting, but. In fact, actually, I think that the text said that, was it this one? The text said that the hard drive is, high-pitched whining and refusing to boot. But still, it's so close to booting that you could at least just replace the hard drive, probably. So, anyway, yeah, it's very nice. And so, first of all, that's cool that somebody posted it on the Facebook group. Thank you for doing that. And also, Hank then followed that up with some scans on vintagecomputer.net. He posted the link to some scans of ads on vintagecomputer.net for this very computer, so you can sort of see some of the marketing for it. And also see what, you know, it looked like when it was new, which is practically the same as what this auction item looks like. So, So thank you, everybody, for pointing that out. It's very, very nice. If I were anywhere near Phoenix, I might well go try to find this.
Oh, you're closer than what I am.
That's true. But it's neat to look at.
I definitely hope someone picks it up, gets it booting. It definitely looks like a nice machine to play with. Okay, well, that was a very brief eBay selection from you, Paul.
Sorry. Next time I'll just double it.
Ah, okay, good. Okay, so let's start wrapping up. So any closing discussions, anything to add?
Well, I have something that's not really retro, but I ordered a pocket chip. We talked about the chip computer and the little pocket chip handheld wrapper around it, basically, with a screen and keyboard. And looking forward to that arriving at some point here, but I have nothing to really say about it yet. Just
no.
Mm-hmm. Seems
yeah.
cool.
Well, yeah. Also for me, in the not quite retro, though the machine is actually 10 years old, I had been doing a lot of my family video editing work and other bits and pieces on a old Power Mac, Quicksilver 2002 model that I bought, funnily enough, back in 2002. But I decided to update to the wonderful world of El Capitan, so I've gone and taken a Mac Pro 1.1, stuffed it full of 48 gig of RAM, custom flashed video card so that I get the boot screen. Yeah, I installed the Final Cut Studio Suite 2 that I had been using back on my Power Mac, and first indications are that it's running quite fine on El Capitan, so all well and good. And also I'll be getting all my virtual machines from various other Windows and Linux machines. I'll transfer them across onto here. And the first system I set up was my Windows 3.1.1 system, so I'm rocking Civ 2 like it's never been rocked before.
But, of course.
Yeah, still got a processor upgrade to do to it. So at the moment, it's not the fastest Mac Pro on the block, but I'll get some quad cores into that soon. But yeah, it was quite a fun experience. The best part about it was is that Apple said that maximum RAM was 8 2-gig SIMs for a total of 16. All the websites out there were basically saying that you could put the 4-gig in, so that would give you a total of 32. But I decided to take a risk. I sourced some 8-gig SIMs. So I've got a bank of 4 8-gig SIMs in there and some 4-gig SIMs for a total of 48 gig, which will be quite useful when I start allocating RAM to various virtual machines, because I still run older versions of software in their own virtual machine environments, and I just have them all networked locally on the machine. So it'll be good to have them all operating faster than their original hardware. So cool. lots of fun. But,
yeah, a lot of non-retro numbers in that.
Yeah,
but gigs and
yeah. But you got to have a little bit of back into real world. But if I was going to build myself a new desktop machine, the machine itself had to at least be 10 years old to apply the upgrades to. So I didn't want to go out and buy something new and build it up from scratch. If I had, it probably would have been a Linux machine, but I decided that I had this Mac Pro 1.1 sitting downstairs doing nothing, and I couldn't let it do that, could I?
Excellent.
So, anything happening in Paul land?
Yeah, well, so just today, there's a store kind of near me. It's kind of on the way into work called Replayed. I don't necessarily need to advertise for them, but they sell basically like old video games. Then they'll recycle stuff for you and buy your old things. And it's primarily kind of like Nintendo era, so a little, like the 90s and stuff, like a little later than what I'm usually interested in. But I stopped by there today because they had briefly put a listing up on eBay which I caught my attention first, and you know, I then realized, oh, these are the people that are actually just right down the street from me. So, so I bought it, you know, a bunch of stuff, mostly like discs and things, and a couple of packagings to games that I have the discs for, but not the packaging for. So I was able to complete a couple things, but it was pretty fun actually, just kind of stopping by and like talking to the people in the store. They say sometimes get things in that are that old, and so I've now left my name with them in case they get other things. As I was kind of hoping that I would see, you know, a little bit more around the store, but it really is all, you know, it's all sort of like Game Boy stuff that is not my nostalgia, but still kind of cool. For some reason, I had a Newton on me, so I showed them my Newton. Oh, that was pretty cool.
Of course, don't we all carry around a message pad?
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah. I just a few days ago got a. There was somebody sold off a Newton. It was like $20 or something, you know. So I bought it because, hey, $20 Newton. I was trying it out, and it kind of works, you know. There's something wrong, I think, with the power or something, so the screen flickers really badly. But so I was bringing it home just to try it out on a actual power supply, and then didn't. But whatever. I had it with me, and I was just trying it, so I figured they would appreciate it, and I think they. Maybe kind of appreciated it. I appreciate it more, I believe. Anyway,
excellent.
That's what's happening.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that looks like that's it for this show. You can find all our show notes at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the VCF forums. We'll include the link for that. You can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And, of course, you can join our Facebook group. You can search for Retro Computing Roundtable, or you can follow the link to RCR Podcast. And, of course, there's good old-fashioned email, so you can always send us your feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we're also a member of the Throwback Network, so if you want to find other retro-inspired podcasts, then that's the place to go. And if you're on iTunes, if you could please write us a review, it'll help other people find the podcast when they go searching. So, until next time,
Retro Compute!